UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on bethinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Tonight, a lecture that I've entitled, If There Is Truth, Could We Even Know It? And I'd like to start with a story, or part of a story. Do you recall C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle? If not, let me try to fill you in just a little bit. In the story, which is the final book in his Chronicles of Narnia, there is an ape, and an ape persuades an ass to place a lion's skin on its back and for the ass to pretend that he, is Aslan, the great lion of Narnia. And the story unfolds with tragedy after tragedy. Because of this duplicity, this falsehood, there is tragedy in the land of Narnia. Parts of Narnia are under bondage. Animals are suffering, and there is abuse. And the ass pretends, while the ape rules. The king of Narnia, Tyrion at that time, made some very, very foolish errors, and that only gave the ape more time to continue his deceit. But in time, some children from this world come to the aid of King Tyrion, king of Narnia. And at last, after a night battle, the ass is revealed as the ass he is, not the Lion King. Yet the sense of disillusionment and exhaustion among some in Narnia is just simply too great. The sense of deception has crushed them and has left them very, very discouraged. And here's where I want to pick up the story. There's an interesting point in the story that I'd like to read to you. It comes at the point where there are some dwarves who had been under the bondage, under the rule of the falsehood that was all around, and they have been brought before Tyrion. And some Calormene soldiers have brought a number of these dwarves who have been working in some of the salt mines under bondage. And the story picks it up here at this point. "Oh, my master," said one of the soldiers, "we lead these mannikins to Calormene to work in the mines of the Tisrock. May he live forever." "By the great god Tash, they are very obedient," said King Tyrion. Then suddenly he turned to the dwarves themselves. About one in six of them carried a torch, and by that flickering light, he could see their bearded faces all looking at him with grim and dogged expressions. "Has the Tisrock fought a great battle, dwarves, and conquered your land?" he asked, "that thus you go patiently to die in the salt pits of Pergoran?" The two soldiers, who had been guarding the dwarves, glared at King Tyrion in surprise, but the dwarves all answered, "Aslan's orders, Aslan's orders, he sold us. What can we do against him?" "Tisrock indeed," added one and spat, "I'd like to see him try it." "Silence, dog," said the chief soldier. "Look," said Tyrion suddenly, pulling Puzzle, that is the ass, forward into the light. "It's all been a lie. Aslan has not come to Narnia at all. You have been cheated by the ape. This is the thing he brought out of the stable to show you. Look at it." What the dwarfs saw, now that they could see it close, was certainly enough to make them wonder how they'd ever been taken in. The lion skin had got pretty untidy already during Puzzle's long imprisonment in the stable, and it had been knocked crooked during his journey through the dark wood. Most of it was in a big lump on one shoulder. The head, besides being pushed sidewise, had somehow got very far back so that anyone could see his silly, gentle donkey face gazing out of it. Some grass stuck out of one corner of his mouth, for he'd been doing quite a little bit of nibbling as they brought him along. And he was muttering, "It wasn't my fault. I'm not clever. I never said I was." For one second, all the dwarfs were staring at Puzzle with wide open mouths, and then one of them, the soldiers, said sharply, "Are you mad, my master? What are you doing to the slaves?" The other said, "And who are you?" Neither of their spears were at the salute now. Both were down and ready for action. "Give the password," said the chief soldier. "This is my password," said the king as he drew his sword. "The light is dawning, the lie broken. Now guard thee, miscreant, for I am Tyrion of Narnia." But the dwarves, as the story goes on, the dwarves who now have been told of the freedom, told of the lie, and heard the password, the light is dawning and the lie broken, how do the dwarves react? Well, the story continues. "Don't they understand?" said Jill, one of the children who had come from this world into Narnia. "What's wrong with all you dwarves? Don't you hear what the king says? It's all over. The ape isn't going to rule Narnia any longer. Everyone can go back to the ordinary life. You can have fun again. Aren't you glad?" After a pause of nearly a minute, a not very nice-looking dwarf with hair and beard as black as soot said, "And who might you be, Missy?" "I'm Jill," she said, "the same Jill who rescued King Rillian from the enchantment. And this is Eustace, who did it too. And we've come back from another world after hundreds of years. Aslan sent us." The dwarves all looked at one another with grins, sneering grins, not very merry grins for dwarves. "Well," said the black dwarf, whose name was Griffel, "I don't know how all you chaps feel, but I feel I've heard about as much about Aslan as I want to for the rest of my life." That's right," growled the other dwarfs. "It's all a trick, all a blooming trick." "What do you mean?" said King Tyrion. He had not been pale when he was fighting, but he was pale now. He had thought this was going to be a beautiful moment of victory, but it was turning out more like a bad dream. "You must think we're blooming soft in the head, that you must," said Griffel. "We've been taken in once, and now you expect us to be taken in again the next minute? We've no more use for stories about Aslan, see? Look at him, an old moke with long ears." "By heaven, you make me mad," said Tyrion. "Which of us said that was Aslan? That is the ape's imitation of the real Aslan. Can't you understand?" "And you've got a better imitation, I suppose," said Griffel. "No, thanks. We've been fooled once, and we're not going to be fooled again." The title of this lecture is, "If There Is Truth, Could We Even Know It?" These are the points that I would like to go through. And as is customary, let me begin with the first one. You speak of truth, but I got to tell you, huh? Hey, let's begin with the ways in which the notion of truth as something really real is under suspicion today. Let me go even further and call it far more than suspicion. Let's use the word objection. 5 objections to this whole idea of truth. You speak of truth, but I got to tell you, huh? Here's the first objection. I'll go back to that. The first objection arises from the conviction that all certainty is suspect, whereas openness is virtuous. I continue to think that the late Alan Bloom, in his book, The Closing of the American Mind, which was written 11 years ago, and given recent American history, you might have thought that it was a self-evident fact, closing of an American mind. But in his book, he put it well. "Contemporary university students," he wrote, "are unified only in their relativism and in their allegiance to equality. And the two are related in a moral intention. The relativity of truth is not a theoretical insight, but a moral postulate. The condition of a free society," or so they see it. "They have all been equipped with this framework early on, and it is the modern replacement for the inalienable natural rights that used to be the traditional American grounds for a free society." And Bloom goes on to write, "The danger these students have been taught to fear from absolutism is not error, but intolerance. Relativism is necessary to openness, and this is the virtue, the only virtue, which all primary education for more than 50 years has dedicated itself to inculcating." Now, I want to suggest in this first point that it's far too easy to miss Bloom's salient point. What is crucial is not the phenomenon of relativism. You miss the point if you're just exercised at the appearance of relativism. Rather, it's the way in which philosophical relativism has taken on a moral garment in our culture. See, the ideas driving the train of what we might call philosophical relativism are not just associated with rebellion or bolshiness. think Christians need to hear this and perhaps sit up a little bit more. See, the reason why many people buy into the non-existence of any meta-narrative or overarching interpretive story is not because they have read Derrida or Foucault. They haven't. Still, it doesn't take a lot to convince people that absolutes, this is certain, this is absolute. It doesn't take people very long to buy into the idea that absolutes can be very, very powerful instruments with which to bash the head of your enemy. Furthermore, it feels more plausible that open-mindedness and listening will accomplish far, far more than strong dogmatic insistence. See, today it seems to most people more moral to hold to philosophical relativism than any idea of absolutes. In fact, to cling to absolutes in our contemporary culture, Christians don't appreciate this. To the vast majority of people, it seems grossly immoral to hold on to absolutes. So it's not just an intellectual thing. It has to do with what is perceived as decent, nice, cooperative, social, and above all, humane. So to speak of truth with any idea of an absolute is to run against the grain. It is to run counterintuitive. Well, let me bring you then to the second objective. The second objection to this idea of speaking of truth has to do with the result of an increasingly dominant global culture. I'd like to spend a bit more time on this point because I think it requires such. See, the benefits of greater global awareness are numerous. I say that cautiously because here I am originally from North America and I'm standing in your midst. I hope you take that as a bit of an irony. The benefits, okay, anyway. It's not a bad thing to realize that there is cultural and social diversity and plurality. It's a good thing to be aware of that. I mean, one of the many, many advantages of traveling is learning to see things through different eyes. Surely we ought to welcome every new insight that helps us avoid ugly nationalism and ethnocentric arrogance. So, standing in a terminal at Heathrow Airport, what do you see? We see different people with differing skin color, differing language, and in some cases, different dress. The West visits the East, and the East travels to the West. Worldwide communications and increased globalization make us feel like the planet is indeed a very small place. It's modernity, not Disney, that makes us sing, "It's a small, small world after all." Yet one of the interesting results and creations of modernity is not so much our global village as our global city. It is the city or urban context that matters, not the village. For the centers of communication, commerce, and consumption are not in the village, but in the city. It's projected that by the year 2000, that's 2 years from now, 90% of the world's population will live in cities. This has crucial ecological and economic implications, but it also implies particular influences upon our cultural points of definition and orientation. See, in the cities of modernity, most of us will live, move, and have our being. Here, too, we will find our reading material, our entertainment, our shopping, our relationships, and, if we're fortunate enough, our employment. Yet none of these exist within a vacuum. In cities, we find diversity and plurality. Just think of going out for a meal and the number of different ethnic foods available. It's great stuff. Such choice is fun and it's rather exciting. I mean, who wants to eat beans on toast all the time? I say that again with a bit of respect. A bit of respect. At the same, however, you know, all this choice and this plurality, there's an obverse side to this diversity. See, diversity and plurality in a city exist within a particular context, a particular unity for all its differences, a unity which is no longer what people used to know or assume. This unity is our global identity or culture. Let me try and illustrate it this way. Picture once more all those restaurants that you and I are going out to. Why are there so many restaurants of different ethnic flavors and approaches? Why? Well, because of diverse market availability and choice. Yet all these eating places share the same city water supply, electric supply, and commercial rate demands. Consequently, when we say in 1998, let's go out to a restaurant tonight, our idea of restaurant is much bigger and multiple than, say, that of our grandparents. Going out to eat is a way of illustrating the idea of expanded definitions and cultural references. So today, we know that one national economy is codependent upon other economies. Think of the tremors felt throughout the world when problems arose in the Far East and more recently, in the Russian markets. Reflect, too, upon the impact of global mass marketing. Today, a young person in Bangkok can wear a Chicago Bulls sweatshirt identical to the one by someone in Evanston, Illinois. Moreover, the Thai youth might know the Bulls standing in the NBA better than the kid from Evanston, Illinois. They probably listen to the same music and consider purchasing the same Reeboks. And as we all know, a Big Mac in Evanston tastes like a Big Mac in Bangkok. Now, in this context, where does a person go for reference? Where does the U.S. kid look for his or her cultural roots? Where would the Thai young person go in search of finding an identity which, while free from nationalistic jingoism and xenophobic anxiety, that can help him or her? Our global culture actually plays down cultural distinctives and national particulars. Okay to have a restaurant, but if you get too focused on one particular ethnic group above any others, well, that's not considered very trendy. The emphasis is upon ethnic plurality, in which greater stress is placed upon adjectives than on the certainty of substance, which is why, for example, the European community has had such a difficult time in former Yugoslavia. They are placing more emphasis upon adjectives than on substance of nouns. So, if there is any use of the noun truth, the linguistic stress should be more on the adjectival modifier, namely Afro-American truth, Asian truth, Anglo-American truth, African truth, Islamic truth, and so on and so on and so on. Truth is a very puzzling idea. Whose truth are you talking about? Let me take you then to the third objection. The third objection comes out of an awareness that today's claim for certainty may well be tomorrow's rejected theory. In my opinion, I think a very good illustration of this is the change in European geopolitics since 1989. With the demise of the Soviet Union, the Berlin Wall did not collapse. It was torn down. This tearing down was a visual symbol of a newfound hope. But it also marked a start in reconstruction. German reunification carried with it not only economic and political demands, there also came the need to reconstruct theories of interpretation. Who are the bad guys now? And who are the good guys now? School texts and curricula had to be revised, namely what was going on in history. Old certainties had to be modified or in some cases completely overhauled. In other parts of Europe, new boundaries came into being, although in some cases they were old boundaries brushed off and reestablished. City names changed. And in all of this, since 1989, people's paradigms had to change. Now, change is not always a bad thing. In fact, it depends upon what you're changing to, which I suppose makes it a good thing or a bad thing. Yet, with change that doesn't always bring improvement or benefit, and since 1989, there are many former Soviet satellite countries which ostensibly were moving towards democracy, but now find that it never was democracy. Why was the West so excited? When the same people in office are basically the same communist officers, because they're the only ones with experience. And so when all this promise of change and restructuring and benefit doesn't bring any improvement or benefit, in fact, the opposite, and many an East European country could claim that, an increasing cynicism develops. Today's claim for certainty may well be tomorrow's rejected theory. Truth is a questionable word. Today's truth may easily be declared null and void and unelectable tomorrow. The fourth objection. The fourth objection has to do with the modernist assumption, and it's still very much amongst us, that moral or religious truth has to do with the unknowable and the non-rational. There is a very long tradition within Western thinking that has kicked religious claims out of the historic and historical field. Within theological circles, for example, 19th century German liberal theology argued that the Jesus of history, historisch, and the historic Jesus of faith, geschichtlich, had little to do with each other. That the two don't relate. So you can tell me that there's evidence that demands a verdict, but that has nothing to do with the Jesus of my faith. I'm more interested in the Jesus. Remember the phrase, we no longer know him according to the flesh? Well, this liberal tradition has come to an end among German theologians and others. But even the stress on the priority of revelation, for example, Karl Barth, has raised even more questions. Was the revelation in history? So-called knowledge of faith is somehow in an altogether different category of knowledge. And in non-Christian traditions, especially some Eastern thinking, there is a stress on illumination and enlightenment. Neither of these involve the role of rationality and reason, per se. Part of the appeal, I think, of Eastern religions and practice among Westerners is the playing down of reason. For reason, so the argument runs, produces dogmatic and absolutist opinions. So truth, when speaking about it from a religious perspective, is a very puzzling word. It implies something esoteric and unnameable. Well, the fifth objection. The fifth objection has to do with the idea that knowledge, knowing something, is actually just another way of referring to interpretation. And boy, there is a universe of difference between knowledge and interpretation. See, you and I do not know things. It comes as a surprise, as much as it is that we are actually interpreting things. An example, suppose we all go outside and I say, is there a tree over there? And I'm pointing to a specific tree. How do you know that there's a tree there? Someone would say, well, it's obvious. You just go up and you touch it. Or someone who's a bit more aware of my argument would say, well, you can taste it. Others would say, well, I can smell this apple tree. But all of those are involving your senses. It's all sensory. It's all experiential. So you and I do not know things as much as we interpret through our senses the things which we claim to, quote, know. Now we use words and expressions like, we all know what chocolate ice cream tastes like. Well, do we now? Is there a quintessential chocolate? Do we really know this? Or is it more a case of our experience, completely sensory, that has led us to question and to this opinion about chocolate? Furthermore, doesn't our knowledge have an awful lot to do with our context, namely cultural, historical, racial, sexual, and so on and so on and so on? See, I think I know objectively and concretely. Yet, how could I? I always interpret and experience something as an I. Yet also remember, you and I are never ever living on a remote island in the South Pacific, as much as we might like to do. Knowledge, so the argument runs, is more often than not communal. So to be more precise, we interpret not only as an I, but also a we. Of course, it is communal with an ironic twist. Knowledge is through the subjective self that pulls down words and phrases that float within the individual's community. I'm tasting this thing called chocolate ice cream. What do I call it? There goes the word chocolate. That's chocolate. Now, this idea of knowledge as being more interpretation, you may wonder, where am I going with this? But as well as the way language is used, is part of the frustration surrounding Bill Clinton. Now, it may frustrate us enormously the way he parses words like, quote, sex, close quote, and, quote, alone, close quote. And now, according to Time magazine, even the word is, close quote. But he is only employing a way of interpreting that many others have advocated for some time now. It's not just his lawyers. Of course, the fact that this manner of speaking and knowing drives most people mad is possibly missed by Mr. Clinton and his lawyers. The simple fact is, we may not have a precise definition of chocolate ice cream, or sex for that matter, but we're fairly sure there's something different about what we call strawberry, or what we call a busy day at the office. So for most people, listening to someone speak of a truth is like hearing a political soundbite, snappy, but really not full of anything. There are probably lots more objections to the idea of truth. And maybe I've put others in your head that you hadn't even considered and are therefore at this point a bit discouraged and may secondly now start to ask, well, great, thanks, Gavin. So dare we still speak of truth? You see, as I said, given the five objections that we've just considered, we might think the game is up. Truth is just a troublesome expression, so let's just take our bat and ball and go home. But for a number of reasons, which I want to present now, I don't think it's time to go home and call it quits. To begin with, I think it's worthwhile asking why we ought to think that all meta-narratives, that's a hip word for saying one story that tells everything else about all other stories, one theory, one supreme story amongst all stories, why ought I to assume that every single meta-narrative always, inevitably, leads to power abuse and oppression? And that may be right, but how do I know that? Is there any narrative or interpretation ever free from abusive power addiction and manipulation? I mean, that's it. That's what I have to say, that anytime anybody has one grand theory, it always leads to women and men being abused or somebody being marginalized. I mean, is it not just as possible that the theory of non-meta-narratives is a power game itself? And in this power game, is there a suppression of some particular idea or opinion? I guess I still need to know why I should entertain the presuppositions and assumptions of theories that dismiss any overarching and unitive interpretation. I'm still waiting to be convinced of something that sure sounds like a meta-narrative in itself. Second, and more complicated, I fear, is the necessity to qualify what I mean, at least, by truth. Bear with me, some of you. I do not hold to the naive view that truth is nothing more or nothing less than the facts. Remember the old Dragnet program? Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. I think that's actually a rather naive view. I say that with respect. That says, the truth is just the facts and nothing more, nothing less. In other words, when I use the term truth, I have something far more comprehensive and unitive than that which is quantifiable and measurable through observation or deduction. Likewise, truth is not simply equated with the ideal. By this, I mean truth is not the supreme definition of particular things like tree, dog, apple, or human being. This would include abstract notions of justice, love, beauty, or honesty. There is no ideal or universal, even though I'm surrounded by all these particulars like a tree, dog, apple, and humans. Thirdly, when I refer to the question of truth, I'm also calling into consideration the problems of, forgive me, ontology and metaphysics. Because both of these disciplines are suspect today. Ontology, the beingness of things. And metaphysics, how things relate to other things. Part of our present crisis of knowledge and truth today has to do with the associated question of being. Does anything really exist to be known? That's why the title of my lecture, If There Is a Truth, because frankly, some might say, I'm not sure there really is. See, if you understand the question, namely about metaphysics and ontology, you've been reading the history of philosophy, and I thank you for that. If you don't understand the question, I mean, how can anybody question that something doesn't exist or doesn't exist? I think the whole point here that I'm at sounds rather loony. It is because you know that in life, certain assumptions are made. Maybe not with great attention and thought. They're made more pragmatically than anything else. Now, my point here is basically this. Cannot the philosopher take experienced realism, you know, like walking down the road or eating a real piece of blueberry pie or watching an episode of The Simpsons, without falling into naivete, thinking the way this blueberry pie that my wife has made, that is the way every blueberry pie ought to taste. That's the definition of blueberry pie. Now, I think that's probably the case, but or thinking the way The Simpsons relate, that's the way Americans relate. I hope you don't think that's the case. I mean, that would lead to despair if you thought that was the case. I mean, is there not some interface, some kind of interface between our experience, along with the interpretation of our experience, and the beingness of something outside of ourselves? In other words, when I'm eating the blueberry pie, I'm not just dreaming it. But there really is something there that I just happen to label blueberry pie, but it's a lot different than Swiss cheese. You see, we humans live and act with a desire for interpretive handles on life. Something I can hold on to and say, yeah, okay, yeah, I know what this means now. There is just too much evidence to deny the human quest for something or some story to make sense of the human experience and situation. You do this when your mother is dying and you're wiping her forehead. You're doing this when you hold a newborn baby. You do this when you fall in love. You do this when you're falling out of love. There's a moral necessity for interpretation. That's one of the crises in the legal system today. Do we have anything on which to base our abhorrence of little children murdering each other? Should we really be concerned with leaders doing what they seem to be doing? We see this necessity played out on not only the academic level, but even more so on the everyday life experience of us. T.S. Eliot said, people cannot bear too much reality. His point is well taken, but there, in that statement appears the question, you know, what is it about reality that people cannot bear too much of? Because I would also say the opposite is equally true. People cannot bear too much of fantasy and make believe. Madness and panic take place if a person leaves Earth for too long. It's not only just that out of the gravitational pull of Earth, their body starts to change. But if you use that as a metaphor, the more into non-reality and madness a person lives, there's a breakdown intellectually, psychologically. Why? Why? Well, is it possible that there are some particular givens of human existence that actually limit the number of interpretations humans place on our existence? In other words, we're back to the chocolate ice cream again. Your taste buds and mine may differ as to the specifics of chocolate. But neither of us, really and honestly, would put cold spinach on a cone and call it a smoother, richer chocolate. There's interpretation, and there's also something called over-interpretation. You've just gone too far. I'm not going to eat that spinach and call it a smoother, richer chocolate. Now, all this is leading me to suggest that we humans face a critical need for an interpretive narration. Somebody tell me, please, what this is all about. I mean, I know you're thinking about that in the lecture, but I'm talking about life as well. This narrative, if it's going to help us, should bear some relationship to our experience of ourselves, things outside of ourselves, and things in the world and universe around us. Now, for those of you that are quick off the mark and have been listening, you might ask right now, yeah, but hold on a second, Gavin. Wait, time out. Why should any narrative necessarily help us? And how would we know what is helpful or not? Good questions. And to which even our narrative has to respond with some kind of definition of helpfulness and unhelpful. You see, it may well be the case that we don't even know what is helpful or good or beneficial without some narrative. See, this need for an interpretive narration that relates to our humanness and the complicated issues of things beingness, ontology, and how they relate to other things, metaphysics, is what leads me to put before you that speaking of truth is not an off-the-wall kind of thing. It's not craziness. To be honest, speaking of the need of truth isn't the thing that really bothers us. What really troubles us is the question, if there is a truth, how could we ever know it? Which is my third point. If there's any truth, and I'm not sure that there is yet, Gavin, how could I even possibly know it? Let me try and place before you a way to approach this question. If there is truth, and maybe you're not sure there is. But if there is, how could I even know it or ever know it? I want to start by rejecting what I think are three initial problems very quickly. I wish I had great time to be anything more than very fast in this labor. After this, I want to try and show you three paradigms of knowledge, two of which are unhelpful and one that I think is the most helpful. First, some important notions to get rid of, to reject, for they create far too many problems for many people. To start, by way of getting rid of some unhelpful things, I think we need to get rid of the notion that says that there's an objective or neutral chair somewhere in the world that I could sit on, and that would help me at last know how everything is. In other words, if I could climb every mountain, ford every stream, and finally get to the end, then at last I'd say, oh, man, I see clearly. No, I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. It doesn't work like that in life. And I think some of the insights of some contemporary thinking has helped enormously in this. At last to make us see what actually many of the medieval thinkers knew. Michael Polanyi's challenge and critique in his work, Personal Knowledge, ought to apply to us here. When he asks, what is our starting point? Why have we chosen this presupposition with which we are working? We can never get rid of our biases. We can never get rid of our presuppositions entirely. But why have we elected some as opposed to others? We are in error in thinking that our knowledge or interpretation is somehow or other neutral or detached. We're never neutral. We always come with a bias. An additional rejection is also this. Namely, the pursuit of absolute and perfect knowledge and interpretation, absolute and perfect, is not only an illusion. It could be something like searching for the Holy Grail. Bless your cotton socks, but the day that you think you'll actually know perfect and absolute knowledge, I won't be around for that. We do not possess, nor can we access, infinite understanding, flawless understanding. Finally, I think we need to get rid of another problem, because I'm not convinced that searching for some, and here I speak to the kind of insiders, I suppose, I'm not convinced that searching for some epistemological bottom line, some foundation, is actually very helpful. If we appeal to some foundation, like Descartes did, like namely to our reason or our empirical ability or experiential self as the unquestioned certainty with which we begin, we are right back at the starting point. And we have not collected the 200 pounds. So with what model or paradigm of knowledge ought we to work? Two models have been used this century, and they will not help us. The first is what has been called positivism. And to a very large extent, it's the way most of us are probably trained in school, and it's why we're still getting hang-ups. And it basically goes like this. There is the observer, namely the you, looking at an object. So you can't look at this object. And basically the way we know something is we just simply look at the object of reality. We use empirical observation. You know, you measure it, weigh it, label it. And if it doesn't work, namely our observation, to describe the object, well, then it's nonsense. If you can't touch it, weigh it, see it, smell it, hold it, then you're wrong. In other words, you start not with any presupposition because you get neutral, you clear your head, and you don't come with any agenda on the table, and you just simply observe. And positivism, particularly in the early part of this century, held a very dominant influence, particularly here in Britain. The second, if I can find it, is a slightly more recent development, although it has its roots in earlier philosophy, is what's called the phenomenalist. Namely, there you are as an observer looking at an object, and you say to yourself, I seem to have evidence of external reality, but, and you bounce back on yourself, I'm really only sure of my sense data. Now, let me unpack that for you a little bit by giving you an illustration of what was said to me by a student at La Brea about a year or so ago, when he said, Gavin, I am terrified that everything I see around me, the you, people at La Brea, life, is just a film playing within my own skull. I can see the image in my skull, and I think I'm seeing something, but Oh, wait. All knowledge is based on the subjective, and it's the experiential. Oh, doom. He's back to the observer. In other words, he sees that there's phenomena out there, but he can't actually say anything real about the phenomena. Though, if you were to watch this guy play football or volleyball, he's pretty good. And he does hit the ball, which is intriguing. He has a bit of a confidence there. I wasn't in a car when he drove. But it's heartbreaking, isn't it, that he would really buy that? Well, if both the positivist and the phenomenalist are, in my opinion, problematic and troublesome because they don't seem to lead us anywhere, where really do we go? What is a better paradigm? I find myself increasingly drawn to what is called critical realism. Critical realism is a way of seeing, of knowing, that acknowledges the reality of the thing known. A text, a letter, a tree, another human being. Critical realism is a way of knowing that acknowledges the reality of the thing known as something other than the knower. Namely, I'm just not imagining this letter from Andrew Fellows. I haven't just projected it onto the table. Matter of fact, the table, you know, it's just not in my imagination. There's something different between me, the knower, and something that's there, including a story about God. Hence, I'm realistic. But I also fully acknowledge that the only access that you and I have to this reality lies along a spiraling path of dialogue between me, the knower, and the thing known. Let me see if I can illustrate it this way. Critical realism would work like this. There's an observer, you and I, and we're looking at objects, not just literal objects, but also a communication, a story, the Bible, the Quran, a film, listening to someone. So it's not just objects on a table. There's an initial observation. I read that letter from Andrew, and Andrew says, Gavin, meet me at the railway station at 10 o'clock. Now, that's challenged by critical reflection. In that silly illustration, I might say, I wonder if Andrew means Union Station. I mean, he just said station. Now, it could be infinite amount of stations. And you know, you never know with Andrew because he travels a lot. But he's asking me to meet him at this station. So, given already my context with him, I have a feeling he may well be, but it could be wrong, either Petersfield or Liss or Liphook. 10 o'clock. Does he mean 10 o'clock in the morning? Well, he left this morning at 11:30, so it's probably not 10 o'clock in the morning, but maybe 10 o'clock at night. I look at, as an observer, at a worldview. I make initial observations. But I'm challenged by my critical reflection. Namely, I don't understand it. some of the things it's telling me don't really make sense. Some of the things do. Whether it's a letter from Andrew, whether it's reading, for example, the pages of the Bible, whether it's listening to a lecture. But I can survive the challenge and speak truly of reality. I can ask critical, realistic questions about the tree out there, about a letter I receive, about watching a film. I can interpret. My interpretation may not be 100% accurate because I'm not so naive as to think that I'll be 100% accurate, but I can ask reflective questions about that which I am seeing and experiencing, even about my own interpretation. And I need not only ask it as a self-individual, but I can ask others within the community. Let me take you one step further and fill this higher view of knowledge, again with critical realism in mind. See, when I use the word story, I'm not talking about fairy tales necessarily, or the one about the guy that goes to the woods. I'm not talking about stories like that. I'm talking about worldviews. All of us work with a worldview. All of us work with a story, to use contemporary language, a way of interpreting, an interpretive narrative. We are storytelling humans. Every culture, every society, every woman or man does this. And we live in a story-laden... How do you do this? I can never do reverse things. Story-laden world. In other words, the world is, that you and I live in is just chock-a-block with all sorts of different worldviews bumping around us. Different stories of, this is the way thing is. This religion, this philosophy. And we make initial observations within a story. In other words, we're not trying to say, as we say to Richard Dawkins, you criticize me, Professor Dawkins, for being a white male working within a Christian Judeo story. Well, that was the culture I was born in. But I'm not so trapped in it that as I listen to the Quran, as I listen to the Eastern philosophy, I'm not so trapped within my own story that I can't make critical observations about other stories. In fact, I may well be challenged by critical reflection on ourselves as storytellers. I could say I could be wrong. Now, I say this cautiously in anticipation of some questions. I'm not trying to say the person walks around always tentative, always doubting, always vague, but isn't that not part of the process by which a person becomes a Christian? Maybe you don't think like this because it wasn't your experience, but at some level you were a storytelling human in a story-laden world and you heard the gospel. If you look at the pages of the gospel in the book of Acts, were they not challenged by critical reflection on themselves as storytellers? Namely, I'm walking with this pagan spirituality. And what does the gospel do at one level? Not all, but at one level. Doesn't it challenge the individual to say, I could be wrong in my interpretation? Men, we are men just like you, sent by God to tell you to turn from these worthless idols to the living God. In other words, change your paradigm, change your worldview. Now, the same thing is said to me as a Christian when I meet people from other faiths and other philosophies. I am a storytelling human in a story-laden world. How do I know anything? I can be challenged by critical reflection, even by my own storytelling, thinking, all right, for the moment, I could be wrong. Now, some brothers and sisters in Christ start to hyperventilate at this point. But was that not exactly what Schaeffer said, that when he said, as if appealing to Schaeffer can win the argument, I say that respectfully, but is that not what he said when he said, if I could be convinced of something that made better sense of the world and my humanity and the universe as it is, would I not at least be willing to take that seriously? In a way, though he was not using that language, that's exactly what critical realism does. It listens, it engages, not for the sake of dialogue so that we can all be friendly with each other. But it employs this critical yet realistic way of knowing. And it finds that alternate ways of speaking truly about the world through the use of new or modified stories, which is exactly, at least speaking personally, what happened to me when I became a Christian. Not only because there was a supernatural birth, But even as you read, I'm so nervous about how Christians are going to react to this point, so I'm trying to protect myself. But is that not indeed what happens even when you read the Bible? Are you not engaging and reinterpreting in light of that which you were reading? Isn't that not what growing in wisdom is all about? Or is it some kind of supercharge that falls from the sky? Now, what we're talking about is a way of a handling the whole question of how can I know anything? How can I be sure of anything? I'm not talking about the whole question of, where did I put it? I'm talking about the whole question of, in a theological sense, of assurance. I'm talking here about the area of knowledge. If there is any truth, how could we ever know it? Now, finally, I want to end here with the story above and beyond all stories. I'm compelled to end with this final section. I guess as you do that, don't you, when you end with a final section. I want you to appreciate... I want you to appreciate that Christianity makes a very fundamental claim, or, to use my language, it makes a narrative statement. If there really is a God, and this God is as the Bible tells us, and if things in life are really the way the Bible tells us they are, then there are implications. That's a big if for some of you. I don't ask you to begin with that certainty. I'm asking you to listen to the story. If, then there are implications. First, there is a way of seeing. There is a way of knowing. And there is a way of being that is truly authentic and legitimate. You become more human. You have a point of reference. You have a narrative that explains not just about God, but about all created reality, including yourself as a woman or a man. Even these words, namely, truly authentic and legitimate, they're not game words used in our silly game of interpretation. If the Bible is correct, then someone outside of our human construct has stepped in and communicated. In various ways and through numerous means, a story above all stories is possible. Not because we storytellers have come up with it, but someone outside of our story camp has come to us. And so every other story then is subject to clarification or even refutation in light of this supreme story, if the Bible is right. Equally, no human being is able to be neutral regarding this story. Second, if the Bible is correct, then we are actually capable of knowing and experiencing truth. Had you thought that what Christians are inviting you to is to some spiritual kind of trip to planet Mars? No wonder you're twitchy about that. I would be too. This idea of you will really know if only you start to believe. No wonder you're nervous about that. It's not a matter of tuning into ourselves. Rather, the basis of how can I actually know something? Or the foundation, if you will, is our ontology, our beingness, our creatures of a personal and infinite triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That's how you know something. You're a creature. Thus, you and I are not trapped in some evolutionary stage or crisis of community or some philosophical quagmire. Can I know anything? Or am I just trapped within my own skull? We can ask in accordance with creation as creation and ourselves as creatures in a specific creation. We can ask creaturely questions within a created creation. We won't know everything. In fact, we may be frustrated with not only our questioning, but even with what we think are our initial answers to our questions. Thirdly, truth, if the Bible is correct, is a dynamic and relevant reality for each of us and all of us. Truth will tell us what it means to be a human being, both personal and social. In this light, we will have a key to seeing and discerning meaning and significance for ourselves, for other men and women, for history, which has such profound importance in the area of morals and metaphysics. This is not to say, may I repeat, this is not to say for 1 minute that our knowledge is all sufficient and exhaustive. We will always know as creatures. Fourthly and finally, if the Bible is correct, then we will discover that truth is not abstract and theoretical. It is not an ideal. It is not a cold absolute. Rather, truth is personal and relational. That's why some people are so nervous when you guys talk about absolute truth. You make it sound frightening and chilling, as if it's a truth. But the Bible is telling me about an infinite personal God. Rather, truth is personal and relational in the fact that it is always the one true God who is truth. This God has acted and spoken. And to use Schaeffer's brilliance, and I'm not just saying this, to use his brilliant expression, he is there and he is not silent. This God supremely became human, knowing and experiencing human existence. The Word made flesh. Not the Word printed out and a fax machine, or the Word emailed to you, or the Word of 10 absolutes come cascading down upon your fragile, broken self. If that's what you mean by absolutes, you are not speaking biblical language. If you're talking about an absolute made flesh, who you could even walk by and not know that he was God in the flesh, then you're speaking in the biblical language. And if you're speaking about a truth made flesh, and whose incarnation was not an abuse of power, but of self-abnegation, the complete opposite of Foucault's idea of power, then you're talking in biblical language. The Lord and Messiah, Jesus, suffered. And in this suffering, he rescues and ransoms men and women. He defeated death in his resurrection to a new humanity, not to a new theory, not to a new set of axioms, a new humanity. He is the king, and by his word he governs and sustains all that exists, but he's still a king, and he will return in history to usher in the restored creation and perfect kingdom on earth. Let's stop and see if there are any ways that I can clear up the mud. If there's any ways that you can help me by adding to this. But at this point, people listening to this on tape may think their tape recorder is broken, so you really do need to step in. Please, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I'm not quite sure how, given the position of critical realism you just outlined, it really gets you an awful lot further than, say, Wittgenstein's Duck Rabbit. What you seem to be saying is that there are different truths. It seems to boil down to different language games, which we're all playing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're assuming, you're making a considerable assumption,
mm-hmm.
That Christianity is true rather than false. Mm-hmm. And you're making that assumption on the basis of your own commitment and presupposition that Christianity is true and other faiths and other worldviews are false. But given the fact that you seem to have abandoned the idea of some kind of neutral objectivity or what Nagel calls the view from nowhere, then I don't see how one cannot avoid some kind of ontological fideism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point, yeah.
An assumption that's a simple leading where one has to choose from the marketplace of worldview. You have plumped Christianity, how do you convince the Buddhist or believer in the great pumpkin about some kind of
Thank you.
To show that is more rational than another world.
Yeah. Thank you very much. A very astute and very helpfully expressed question. And I would have to confess that initially the reason why the question has arisen is because of the lack of clarity on my part. Remember that what I'm engaging with, sorry, not remembering, because I probably wasn't very clear at this point. I'm talking about the fact that I am considering worldviews as a story of interpretation of the reality with which I'm trying to live and work and understand. I'm looking for a narrative framework. And I'm asking critical, realistic questions about the story that I'm hearing in light of the already functioning experience in life with which I'm working. Therefore, I'm a realist. Okay, but probably this isn't coming out very clearly. So I'm doing more than just sort of a fideist kind of leap, saying I'm going to begin somewhere. Well, I'll just begin with a priori this commitment to Christianity. No, I'm not beginning with that. I am beginning, as everyone begins with, some story. And my appeal to Christianity actually is not, strictly speaking, my own experience, although experience has something to say in communication with someone. It's part of fleshing out the story that I'm asking you to consider. How do I avoid the sort of multiplicity of worldviews, saying, well, you know, take your pick, each one, given our dilemma, is as good as the other? I'm interacting with this sense the phrase I used was dialogue, a dialogue between me, the knower, and that which I'm trying to use to interpret that which is objectively my dilemma, namely the world I'm living in, the experience I'm living through, the death that I'm traveling through, the love that I'm experiencing. And it's in that dialogue that I'm not exercising a fideist leap. I'm recognizing that I can't find that neutral chair, that chair observation from nowhere. And so now I'm engaged in dialogue with different worldviews. Dialogue, listening to these worldviews, saying, what do they tell me about the universe as it is, the me I already know? I'm asking questions of consistency, congruence. In other words, does this story fit? And that's not standing on the foundation of experience or rationalism. Because I recognize limits to both experience and rationalism. But I am asking for, does this worldview fit? Does it make sense of even that which even I perceive? Am I coming any closer to...
Well, the question is, does it fit with what?
What have I just illustrated?
You're making some kind of presupposition which doesn't seem to be... You haven't uncovered clearly enough. I mean, if you're saying that you're looking for a story which fits with...
Well, I'm sorry, maybe I'm being a bit thick. I gave illustrations like my mother dying, falling in love, war, driving down the street, receiving a letter from Andrew. That's the something that I'm asking, does this worldview fit? I refer to culturally perceived givens of human experience, the fact that I, as an observer, I'm living within a world in which there are initial observations of the world around me and myself. That's the something with which I'm asking, does this story fit? Well, there's no other way I can know anything than through experience. I mean, how else would I know something? Through a sensory and experiential way.
Sure, yeah.
Experience, as you mean it, just sort of the situation, the existential experience, yeah. That's the context. That's the stuff with which I live, and about which that I find every single worldview trying to explain. It's very interesting that maybe most worldviews are trying to answer the stuffness of life. Now that's intriguing. Why is that? They seem to be almost unavoidable questions, namely the stuffness of life, language, experience, perception, of what of this human endeavor, this human experience. Do you want to come back?
Just to come back, I mean, if it is based on experience, then that still leaves the original question largely intact, it seems to me, because if you're saying I'm trying to look for a story or some meta-narrative or whatever to fit my experience, then why is one story better than another?
Okay. Again, it's this whole point of congruence, of consistency, of asking, now, does this story require for me to make huge radical leaps of either imagination or experiential existence? Does it seem to belie the way men and women seem to be already existing? Does it clarify? Remember, I'm looking for an interpretive narrative. I'm not being precise, or you're hearing one thing and I'm trying to communicate another. I'm talking about an interpretive narrative. Namely, this is what such and such means. Not fit as in jump into my circle and confirm and conform to my circle. I'm actually saying, I don't understand what things like beauty, justice mean. I can entertain notions, but I have no idea if those things are illusory. I have no idea whether justice is just like a Hollywood film set, namely it looks good on the front, but behind it, it's just scaffolding. So I'm looking for more than, so give me some story which will confirm me, because most worldviews don't confirm. There's always some disturbing aspect. How do I know which one is better? I suppose one, this is the critical dialogue. I mean, it's not going to be a case of, through an initial observation of any worldview, you'll say, oh, that makes sense. What I'm asking is, does this worldview, as it challenges my earlier understanding, does it clarify and provide an interpretation which makes better sense of that with which I've been previously working? Or if it doesn't, on what basis have I rejected it? And likewise, it's challenging me to ask, why have I begun with this assumption? See, that's another thing that worldviews do. They challenge, why have you begun with the presupposition with which you were working? Why that one? Why not another one? Why do you begin with a closed universe? Why do you begin with an open universe? Do you begin with a universe of non-personal beginning? Why? Why did you do that? I mean, you may be right, but a worldview will challenge and say, no, why that presupposition? Why not another? Does that presupposition with which you begin, where will that carry you on your journey? What will it say about humanity? What will it say about history? What will it say about death? What will it say about life? So that's sort of where I'm going.
So how do you know which one to start with? Does that not oblige you to look at all worldviews? At what point do you decide this is the right one? I can be certain that if I continued looking at other ones, I wouldn't find one that fitted better.
But at one point, I don't know if one ever really stops asking that question at one level. I'm not sure that realistically one ceases ever to engage in that critical reflection. One ought not to, which is a world from speaking to us to say that, well, now as Christians we're holding on to everything loosely and tentatively, as if around the corner the next persuasive argument would come. Can one go on an infinite quest of assessing every single worldview? I think at one level, the validity of your question is a bit of a challenge. Yeah, I think it's important and incumbent upon people to engage in critical realism, even about the narratives with which we are working, which would include the Christian. Because in light of that which I have considered, and others within the community within which I live and work, I realizing that I'm not an autonomous individual, that others have engaged in this exercise, I've yet to see a better narrative that can clarify. And that within that narrative, there's something more than just a propositional account. There's also a claim that at one point in history, a dead man was raised again to a new body. And I find that within that story, the apex of the story. And I find that troublesome. So, does one go on an endless pursuit? I think psychologically none of us do that. None of us go on forever and ever and ever. We probably go mad if we do that. It sounds entertaining to be on, and it sounds noble to be on a constant quest of saying, I'm not settled down anywhere.
Because at one point in a human situation, we have to settle down somewhere because we function. See, that's where we can be slightly of two or three different minds. We say, no, I have not settled down on any worldview. But in fact, de facto, we have settled. Just simply, just living and moving, driving our car, speaking. And that, I think, is where I find it very helpful when Schaefer talks about the unavoidability of the mannishness of man. You just can't get away from being human, though many people try. That when I walk outside, I can act as if there's non-reality, but I'll bump my head on trees. That's what I mean by the givenness of it. That in order to function, and to function as human beings, I don't mean deciding what religion we'll be in. Now, you're squirming, so you don't like what I'm saying, so come back.
No. Yeah. I just mean what sounds like, you know, what you're saying is, okay, well, I'll reach a point and, hey, well, that's good enough. So, you know, maybe this worldview is right, maybe it isn't, but it feels good enough to me. I no longer have an obligation to find out whether it's really right or not. I'm going to stop here. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. No, I'm not saying that at all. Certainly that would not be a Christian claim that I have arrived, I have found it, I have reached the definitive conclusion of my searching, and that there are no further need for critical reflection upon even that which I entertain today. Experientially, though Christians will probably not tell you this, experientially, moment by moment, they are asking critical reflective questions. They have to. Because experientially, not to contradict myself, and psychologically, there's so much that actually seems at odds. There's a lot of Christianity that seems counterintuitive. We walk by faith, not by sight.
Asking critical questions, but within the box.
Yeah.
I'm not now going to go outside of the box. I may change the shape of the box, but I'm not fundamentally moving from this worldview to another one.
Well, outside the box, and you know, what do you define as not? You're saying you're stopping to find the right one. Outside the box, how do you know the truth now?
Can you elaborate on that one? Because I think what I'm hearing is that this.
I'm saying, I think this chap is questioning you.
That's a good question.
It's a good question within a Christian framework. But I think he's assuming a Christian framework to question you.
Well, here we are, we're saying, what he really says is no, you're saying what he really says. Yeah. But the reason why you put your finger on a good point is that the question is, I think, assuming some platform, namely the pursuit of that which is, you know, if I say I'm going to keep looking for something which makes the best sense, I'm going to make something, and the criteria is almost independent of that which you are looking at. In fact, so one is working with a working assumption that I need to find something that is the supreme. I need to find something which is the best. What I'm suggesting is that when I talk about congruence and consistency, that there's no way that I can actually step apart from all of these worldviews and say, now, the measuring rod that I'm going to use is the following. In other words, that strikes me yet again as just another form of foundationalism. Namely, this is the stand on which I'm going to now evaluate everything, including Christianity. But what I'm saying is that it seems to me that every worldview is trying to answer these questions, and that as I engage in the dialogue as a storytelling human in a story-laden world, and I listen to what Christianity is saying as well as others, it does strike me that there's greater congruence and consistency when I hear these stories, including, as I said a long time ago, part of the story including this claim of a resurrected king. Now, I just want to come back, Nigel, to... I'm sorry, I just don't know your name.
No.
Okay. John. Okay, Nigel. Okay, Nigel.
I thought about it. In fact, Jesus described himself as a rock in the desert which drifts every way up. One rock, and yet, I think they're getting all the way to some extent. And it's fair to say that once you bump into Jesus, that is a point of time which
point in our critical realism that you always have to explain why many of us remain Christians and those who give it up and go off and try and get a worldview, because you've met or fallen over this. So you have to explain it, everybody has to explain you to one way or another. And one of the reasons why we're Christians in the market and to feel that it's Christian tradition of Jesus fits the fact, or fits the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably the one response that one could give is, well, Nigel, Christians would say that, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. You know, that would be the one thing that you would stumble over, and once you bump into that. But I could tell you something that I could stumble across, and boy, once I've stumbled across that or met that, bumped into that, whatever the verb is, I'm satisfied. There is that tension, and I think it would be foolish of me to say that that attention doesn't exist. Although, you see, I still can't get away from the fact that it sounds noble that we're continuously looking, and it sounds noble that we can be on this pursuit. And I think also one has to possibly suggest, are there really an infinite amount of differing worldviews available today? Yes?
Am I being very naive or stupid? I don't know which. But can't you make it an argument that what Jesus was saying when he said you have to lose your life, people assume they mean you have to give up your money, or you have to give up your health, or you have to give up something concrete.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could take a view that Jesus was saying you have to lose your box. You have to give up your circle of reality. And your faith, when you live in faith, is you're living without a box. You're living beyond the meaning of life. You're living beyond the circuit. What we're doing is looking for another box. Well, Jesus said, there is no other box. Faith in God takes you out of all the boxes into another non-boxy place where the only reality is faith. There's no law. The law won't save you. The law of any dynamic that you put on the board there will not save you, because it's death. Because down every law, down every box is a dead end. You come to the edge, either the edge of your own experience or the edge of your own culture or the edge of something.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the end of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that is God, brackets Jesus. And he's saying, lose your life and you find it, because you don't need a box. You just need faith.
Yeah, I follow what you're saying. I'm afraid I just don't, I can't agree with it.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's a box that is no box, or a box by another name. Now, hold on a second. We're only talking at the level here of, I mean, I haven't used any reference to the supernatural. I haven't used any reference. I mean, I haven't even looked at the biblical story yet. So you're quite right to anticipate certain things, but I'm really just trying to deal with the immediate question of, could there even possibly be a truth? And how could I possibly even know it? Now, I'm trying to offer a model that at least can speak into the present confusion of knowledge and how people talk about knowledge. This is where I have to disagree with you, that if Scripture is not going to address questions of meaning and significance, for example, if it's not going to address the already givenness of my existence, which is inescapable, unavoidable, and, for example, isn't going to say something about death, for example, then whatever else you tell me about this faith, it's a jump into a realm that may be nice, but right now I can't jump out of the realm that I'm in, namely this created reality, And therefore, you see, when I open up the pages of the Bible, I find actually the opposite of what you're telling me. Namely, it's actually saying that now I can see things more clearly. And now I've got an interpretive narrative. In fact, that's why I don't like the song, "Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus and the Things of This World Will Grow Strangely Dim." Now, don't lose me, because I'm not denying that there's a death that has to be undertaken when following Christ. A death to actually intellectual arrogance. A death even to the pursuit of, I can discover the answer and handle on things. Now, I'm agreeing with you on that. But if it's not addressing the issues that men and women are existentially facing, and telling me, no, ignore those, die to all those, instead now come to another realm of spiritual existence, then I fear that this...
I think if you want to put the kingdom of God into this world, interrelational, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's part of this world, then I think you are driven down the way you're going. But then mm-hmm. he said, it's not, my kingdom is not of this world.
Well, he also said the kingdom is breaking in. It's very interesting. You're telling me about a kingdom that's not of this world, and the king actually stepped in this world. The king became incarnate. I mean, I find that extraordinary. I'm talking about a new, restored creation. I find the Bible concluding saying, now there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth.
You look around, it isn't there.
Well, of course not. It hasn't come yet. I mean, if this is it, I'm punching out. I guess.
It might be helpful just to zoom out for a second here and address once again the question of how we make sense of this plethora of worldviews on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And here I think it's useful to appeal to Schaefer once again when he puts varying worldviews in a fairly small array of classes, if you like,
mm-hmm.
to draw out the common points from the majority of the most popular ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes the whole problem a lot more manageable, because if you've only got a set of a finite set of answers to the problem of what the universe is and who we are, then it doesn't take all that long to be able to evaluate those in terms of one's perception of one's own reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly a confusion I felt very much before I came here. It just seemed impossible to examine critically and thoroughly every single perspective on the universe mm. seems to be
on. Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's much more coherent and cogent than my ramblings when I alluded to the fact that I don't think there's an infinite variety of worldviews with which to evaluate as stories. I agree with you. I also think of Harold Netland's book, Dissonant Voices, in which he compares some of the principal war religions and philosophies and concludes that there are basically five points of concern that all of these different worldviews share, and that it's not an infinite variety of options with which to choose. So you said it far better than I did, Angus. Yes.
I query that in that that may be his fine interpretation.
Yeah, fair enough.
The whole evening here, I was mm-hmm. very worried about our understanding of the meaning of words.
Mm-hmm.
The necessity are restricted to using words mm-hmm. to toss these ideas around.
Mm-hmm.
And each of these ideas which we're tossing around
mm-hmm.
are our own personal understanding of what we're meaning when we're making the noises that our mouths are doing, which come from the sum total of our own experience. So when anyone uses a word, particularly more complicated,
mm.
We don't mean exactly the same thing by it. We cannot,
mm.
because we're restricted to our own personal experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we can only begin to hone in on real dialogue when we have shared experiences. That's why Christ had to come into this world to tell us about heaven.
Mm-hmm.
To have a shared experience with us. As
man-based individual. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where are you going with that, David?
Well,
think what I'm trying to say is that earlier on there was a discussion, which I'm sorry, let me remain, that you raised about whether we have to go on and on searching for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in everybody's life, one's final conclusion is always tentative. It's the definition, my understanding of love, my understanding of some idea. It's tentative. It's the one that up till now I've honed in and worked in mm-hmm. my worldview. But if something happens tonight which completely changes that, then I have to change it.
Yeah, now someone could easily come back though and say, now David, do you seriously now, come on, be honest with me. Do you really seriously suspect that there's going to be something really significant that can change you from your conviction about the gospel? Do you seriously entertain that possibility? How would you respond to that question? That's one I'm often asked.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. President.
I know what I mean by God.
Okay, whatever it is that you mean.
It's not what you mean. There may be lots of common points.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, well, David, let me ask you this. If they were able to find the bones of Jesus of Nazareth and could substantiate within a relative degree of plausibility that he never was raised from the dead, now, how would that affect your understanding of what you call gospel? Yeah.
But we're really trying to talk here tonight about truth.
Yeah. Sorry, what time is it, David? I don't. Do you have the time?
10:25.
What?
By my watch, my time's
dead. Okay. All right. Well, that's good because it's only 8:05, so I can start again. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
That's where all of us are in these differing places.
Well, now, David, that's not actually functionally true because you are able to engage in the exercise of communication. And the reason why, well, that's why people are up and walking out in frustration. No, they've been also because it's tired. You put your finger on one aspect of reality that language requires clarification.
Yeah, continuing.
Yes, but it's not so dysfunctional that it can't convey some degree of communication, which can be both verified, can be examined, can be assessed critically, and which more than one person can have a high degree of complementary sharing of that interpretation. That interpretation of things is not so unlimited as to create a complete chaos of interpretation. You yourself know that in life that doesn't always work, that there's a functional degree of communication of language. Not exhaustively. If you're pressing me saying, Gavin, don't you realize that language is not exhaustive? I never made that assertion. I always said that language needs both context and that there is the interpreter as well as the communicator, which is part of the complexity of the function of language. But to say that means that any kind of interpretation is just as realistic and appropriate as any other interpretation, and it can't be criticized and critiqued and assessed, I'm sorry, I find that very difficult as well as not demonstrable in the way that human existence goes about its work. So maybe it's that you think I was saying one thing and you're asking for clarification, and the fact that I can clarify and hopefully be a bit clearer in my communication, I think shows that language is not so chaotic that some form of knowledge is possible. Now, if you're yet again saying, but see, you don't know it exhaustively. I've never claimed that. So we're talking about something that I've never claimed. But if you're going in response to that, saying, well, yes, just because, inasmuch as we can't know something exhaustively, don't you see that it's impossible to know anything and communicate anything? Is that where you want it to go that way? Yeah. I didn't think you were, because I was able to understand you.
All of our ideas are defocused.
I think it's called impartial. Yeah. Isn't that what you're saying?
Hmm.
And that our humanness affects our understanding of language, our use of language, our reading of language? Well, now I'm really panicking. Hadn't I communicated that? I thought I had. Maybe I didn't use
fuller sentences. No, I'm sorry. Maybe my fault. Andrew.
If there is a truth to be known, mm-hmm. And it's communicated through the story,
mm-hmm.
And we are able to recognize that truth, then the truth, God, if I may say, must give each of us individuals the ability to recognize
yes.
the truth.
Yes.
I'm taking that from the
That according to the story is how it works, yes.
Therefore, can I just ask a question? Mm-hmm. I couldn't to you. Mm-hmm. Why is it that some who hear the gospel mm-hmm. and hear various other worldviews
yep.
decide not to hear the gospel?
According to the story and to the one who articulated this worldview in its greatest clarity, the problem is not my intellectual ability or inability, it is the disposition of my heart and the inclination. Problem of my incurvedness of my will. So it's not a deficiency of knowledge.